Welcome to ProCo 360, the show that, like many, features successful entrepreneurs, but unlike the others, all our guests choose Colorado. I'm your host, Dave Tabor, and I say live, work, love Colorado because success is different in Colorado. Success is multidimensional. We all want our work and our lives to be amazing. You, I, and my guests get that. In this episode, I'm putting together sort of a compilation of some of the high points of all my interviews from 2018, all my guests throughout the year. I hope you'll enjoy it. Thanks to show sponsors, the Colorado Chamber of Commerce, Community Banks of Colorado, and MicroStar Keg Logistics. They support this show and they support Colorado entrepreneurism. Here we go with a compilation of 2018. Here's Todd Dutkin, Fresca Foods.
What qualities do you look for to see sort of, because you must have a filter, a lens through mm-hmm. which you look to say, these guys are going to be successful or they really don't have the potential. What works and what doesn't work for you when you evaluate?
So those attributes, the people, mm-hmm. I mean, if it's got a great leader, a visionary leader, the product, we like big categories. We like categories like cereal and bars and butters. Those are great categories mm-hmm. because we don't have to do the consumer, educate consumers. Mm-hmm. There has to be either profits or a path to profits. So some of the startup brands may not necessarily have the cash flow yet in their systems. Did I mention last is the product itself?
Yeah.
The product itself has to be something that you really believe in.
Matt Talbot, Ghost Spot Check.
I'm intrigued by the strategy of having influential accounts.
Yeah.
And you started by getting influential accounts. PepsiCo was one of your early ones.
Yes.
Dannon
yep.
was one of your early ones. So what, talk about that strategy.
Yep. So from day one, and I got in a really big argument with our CTO about this very early, where he argued that we should go SMB and then grow into the enterprise. And I said, no, we're going to go enterprise from day one. And the reason why I thought that was important is my vision for the company has always been to build a large software business. And I think the best large software businesses look like enterprise software businesses. And I do believe that the motions to get there are different enough where, sure, you can start an SMB and graduate to enterprise, but I would rather begin working that muscle as early as possible. Understand account management, integrations, customer service.
Well, that's all cool, but you got to have something pretty robust
yes.
to sell to a big client.
Yes.
And usually, because you want to ship quickly,
yep.
you want to go with your earliest viable product, and that's not suit, right? So how do you balance that?
So what we did really well, I think, is that we went very robust on a very, very thin set of capabilities. So mm-hmm. we said we're going to be all about getting the right tasks to the right people. And so the other capabilities like scheduling work shifts and doing time tracking. All of that's off the table, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The only way we can go enterprise is to focus on one differentiated thing that we believe we can do better than anybody in the world. And we're going to get really deep mm-hmm. there. And we know that these enterprises we're going to be integrating with any number of different tools because they have complex product portfolios.
Yeah.
And so that was the trade-off that we made. And we've seen that because our product isn't as good of a fit for a smaller company that needs an all-in-one solution.
Sure, sure. Did you go to these? Who was your first big client?
Dannon.
Dannon.
Yep.
Did you go to them and say, guys, look, we don't have any big clients. We want you as our big client. And by the way, we hope we're ready for prime time, but we might not be and we plan to get better. I mean, how do you do that?
It's really, really hard. And we were lucky enough to have kind of three that moved in conjunction. It was Panera, Dannon, and PepsiCo. And we went to them and we were very honest that, yeah, we are early, right? But we believe what we're building is different enough and special enough that you'll find value in it. And what we'll commit to do, and this is where it has to be done by the founders. You have to sit down and look across the table and look them in the eye and go, hell or high water, I'm going to make this work.
Cortland Mathers Suter, Aspen Ridge Recovery.
You know, you take mission-driven sort of to a whole new level, right? So, when you're running a company, how do you start putting boundaries around being mission-driven and still running a successful business?
Yeah, it's a funny question because I think you're right. I mean, there's no argument that your mission is the recovery and the life-saving features of the recovery from drug addiction, it is, you better be mission-driven, right? And then when you couple that with a real empathy and a staff that is primarily made up of people who are in recovery themselves, there is something of a challenge with respect to building that into a successful, profitable business.
And you're a for-profit. You're not a nonprofit, to be clear, right?
Yeah, so. Absolutely. So what I think it comes down to is understanding that the better that the company does, the more people we can help. And I think that tenet of our of the overall mission that we have, that to treat better and to treat more, we have to be better as a business, and that means profit. Yeah. It really helps. It allows us to frame everything effectively.
Well, you know, the healthcare industry is pretty maligned based on its sort of approach to being transactional, right? Yeah. So how do you manage that notion in your own head and with your team members?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I think a big piece is really separating operations from business. So our operations are... Our operational team are not aware of or made aware of the financial elements of any of the care that they
really
provide.
So the face to face caregivers are not exposed to profitability, costs, and charges, anything.
Nothing. I absolutely
is that conscious?
Don't allow
Do you set that?
Absolutely.
Talk more about that. How did you go? That's an interesting decision you made.
I being from the social work realm, I take the National Association of Social Work code of ethics to heart. And one of those pieces is that your the care cannot be augmented in any way due to financial circumstances. So was what guided me towards creating policies and procedures to ensure that that would happen. Because it's very easy when you're a private practitioner to not do that. You just don't do that.
Well, you saw that in other facilities.
Exactly.
You're the one that you went to, right?
So, right. So what I, you know, wow. And you see what it does, and you see what it does to the culture and to the community of the clients, which is, that is our job, and that's frankly our product.
Kevin Voles, Eldorado Climbing Walls.
When I started off in the outdoor industry in the late 80s, it was still pretty immature. And if you look where it is now, it's very pro-style, and you have billion-dollar companies. You know, you think of the North Faces of the world.
Sure.
When I started selling North Face gear, you know, they were a pretty small company relative to where they are now. And so where the commercial climbing wall industry is a little bit where the outdoor industry was probably 20, 25 years ago, where you're just starting to see, you know, it was just a bunch of climbing, dirtbag climbing bums, like starting companies and trying to make a living. And now you're seeing a little more professionalism and a little more business strategy.
So that's kind of interesting, because maybe what you learned as you were growing up in the outdoor industry, where companies like, whether it's North Face or Go Light or whatever, were sort of moving into a mainstream, I suppose now you could shepherd the climbing wallet business in that same way.
Well, and I think that's one of the things that I was able to bring to El Dorado is you guys are running yourself like a mom and pop business. You know, you got to kind of step up to the plate a little bit better. And you're starting to see that throughout the industry. It's starting to attract some private equity money. You're starting, you know, there was the first big merger in the indoor commercial gym space last year. So you're starting to see it grow up a little bit.
That's interesting. How long do you think, if there is such a thing as deciding when an industry might mature?
Well, I think what I witnessed in the outdoor rec products industry is it took about 40 years, maybe a little bit longer, right? And
I would think things accelerate a lot faster.
The 60s was, you know, a lot of companies started in the 60s, and now they're, you know, there's these bigger companies, right?
Yeah.
And the first commercial indoor gym in the United States started in 1987. Wasn't much going on. When the Boulder Rock Club, the El Dorado's former owners, founded in 1991, it was, I don't know, maybe the fifth commercial gym in the U.S. Now there's a lot, right? There's over 400 commercial climbing gyms in the United States right now.
Jeremy Morgan of Elements Massage. This national company is based in Colorado, and if you want to learn more about this industry, I think you'll like this clip.
Makes that business consulting relationship a lot easier, because I'm able to say, look, here's how we're doing it.
Do you ever implement an idea from a franchisee into your test?
Oh, absolutely.
Like,
I mean,
what?
We do that all. I mean, frankly, most of our best ideas start from franchise locations. And so, as an example, I mean, the cupping test started in franchise locations as an example.
Do they need your permission?
They do.
And so they'd contact you and say, look, I want to experiment with this. What do you think? And you say, yeah, in this case, you say
that's
yes.
That's right.
And let us know how you do.
That's right. Now that can become chaos if you're not careful. So we've put a process in place. We call it our innovation laboratory. Mm. We put in place where franchisees are able to submit whatever ideas they want to test. And then my team goes and picks the three or four things we want to focus on for the year.
That's
and we let
cool.
those tests go into place.
That's really cool. It's another collaborative approach
That's
to
right.
working together in the field.
That's right. Like I always tell folks, I don't have to have the idea. There's plenty of ideas out there. Our job is to help to make sure that the franchisees are executing it really well. Yeah.
So. That's really cool. I interrupted you when I had this brilliant question and I still want to answer.
Okay.
If you could think about a lesson you learned at Smashburger that you're now applying in Elements, what is that?
So we did a lot of great things at Smashburger. It was a hyper growth brand. We had a super cool brand that people loved. And one of the things that we did extremely well that was differentiated is we had a regional offering. Our menu is actually different in every city across the country, which is an incredibly difficult thing to do at scale, especially when you're growing that fast. As I take kind of some of those lessons and what I did while we were running marketing there, it's how do you kind of capture that energy that comes from all the PR and consumer awareness and bring that into a brand that's a little bit older, that's not just brand new.
Yeah.
And so this gets to how we innovate within our brand. And so we've got a couple of ideas that we're working hard on that I'm not ready to announce here.
Oh,
but
come
boy,
on.
how do we take that idea and turn it to a big PR launching point? Because we were fantastic at that at Smashburger and it hasn't historically been a huge core competency of Elements that we're trying to build.
Here's Chris Voss, author of Never Split the Difference, former head hostage negotiator for the CIA.
Yeah, I want to win, but I don't want you to lose. And I don't want you to feel like you lost. Even one of my favorite stories from the book, we got a terrorist, a sociopath on the other side, a killer, a murderer, straight out of the movies, Bad Guy. And he lost everything in the negotiation that I coached in the Philippines. And after it was all said and done, he called the guy that I coached on a phone to say, they should promote you. You're really talented. So although he didn't win, he didn't feel like he lost. He felt like he got treated great. And the other guy was a sociopath. We used empathy on a sociopath. So, I don't necessarily want you to feel like that you lost. I think that's important long term.
If you don't come to an agreement, is that an unsuccessful negotiation?
No, because no deal is often better than a bad deal. And if you made a bad deal, by definition, you made an agreement, but you just got in the middle of something that might actually slaughter your business. So not getting an agreement is not a loss.
But I mean, does that make you feel, does that hurt one's ego? Does that hurt one's esteem or even one's sense of objective if you go to the table and then you walk away without a deal? How do you
treat
your clients?
Because you're going to get slaughtered at the table. If you feel like you lost by not getting a deal, somebody's going to hold you hostage over that. And that's a real weakness.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. Have you seen that done through your practice where you've had to coach people say, walk away?
Well, absolutely. I mean, and what kills entrepreneurs more than anything else, there's a saying in sales, not getting the deal isn't a loss. Taking a long time to not get the deal, that's the worst possible sin.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're coaching a client recently that had been pursuing a deal for 18 months. Now, we call this proof of life. And are you the favorite of the fool? Now, our immediate diagnosis is that they were the fool. So in one interaction, we coached them to get the potential client to admit that they were never going to get the deal. Never. Chased it for 18 months. We got him out of that in less than a week. The flip side to that was the CEO was just at a training we did in New York. He said, holy cow. He says, after you guys got me out of that deal, he was trying to do a real estate deal. He said, I subdivided the real estate and I ended up making more money on the subsequent deal. I'd never found that better opportunity if you guys hadn't got me out of that.
Blake Adams of Denver Flea.
50% of this is the consumer, right? And people are looking for brands that help either reinforce who they believe in themselves to be, or looking to help them become something else. And so with Andy and Mountain Standard here, when people are moving to the state of Colorado, they want to get into the lifestyle here, and they want to immerse themselves in everything that Colorado has. Well, part of that is needing the right gear. And so when you can go out there and buy from a brand that helps support the lifestyle that you want to live, that are made by people that are similar to you, that you can connect with, I think that that's a really amazing opportunity for brands.
Bill Grable of Grable Companies. And if you've ever really wanted to know what driving a company culture is about, you'll enjoy this one.
I do make it a point to be visible and, if you will, in the field in each location at least a couple of times a year.
Well, let me ask you this, because the comments are pretty impressive. Here are a few of the comments. Stellar workplace and corporate culture, motivated and cares about being a great human being as well as a leader, ability to grow, and then, as you mentioned, truth, love, integrity. I mean, maybe you can't answer this, but there aren't a lot of CEOs that people say those kinds of things about.
Well, thank you. you know, I think it just depends on where you insert your energy in terms of what are the cornerstones of your business. And my observation is so many businesses' cornerstones are simply around making money for the people at the top, and then everything else kind of falls downstream and in a subordinated kind of context. The way we really work in our organization is to recognize we'll never be special to any customer out there unless we're special first to the people who choose to work with us and share our mission about trying to be, you know, a trusted global brand, and then embrace the notion of a duty of care and everything that it represents. And that's a big ask. But I get inspired by looking at people who work in hospice or who work in emergency rooms or who work with special needs children. And there are people on this planet that are wired as extraordinarily selfless caregivers who derive great satisfaction and energy about being of service to others. So we know those people are on this planet, right? And so while we're an industry not many people would have top of mind, what we have to do is identify the people who are wired that way, and then we can train them to do the very specific things that customers expect of us.
Brian Freeman, Growers Organic.
It's a risky business.
Yeah, I would think so.
It really
is. And the notion that, you know, your product isn't like a hard good.
Nope.
So you have X period of time to sell it and then get it out the door.
Yep. Some as short as 5 days, some as long as 21. And it's fun. It keeps me going.
Well, when I think about a guy though, that runs an organic business, you know, I suppose most of us would think, you know, oh, he's a soft hearted, happy go lucky guy. He's all organic. He's getting his hands dirty. You know, did going through bankruptcy change, you know, sort of maybe your temperament around running the business?
You know, I would like to say that it did, but I really feel that I've become more compassionate, as crazy as that might sound, just because going through what I went through, I saw a lot of people come to my rescue. I saw a lot of people rally around Growers Organic and say, you know what, we're here for you. And so you tell me if you need me to, you know, I had many farmers. I had a farmer that I owed $160,000 to, and she wrote the check herself and said, Brian, you pay me when you have the money. And those are the kinds of relationships that, you know, and she was one of them that went to the USDA and said, Brian and Growers Organic is a fixture. And if it wasn't for Brian, I wouldn't have a home like I have in Colorado where I can ship organic produce. And this is a woman that Sue Hager and her husband were the first people to ship organic broccoli back in 1978 out to New York City. And so that kind of stuff was flattering and humbling. So, you know, when you ask that, there's some things that I at some level I have become not tolerant to a few things, because now I'm much faster to call a spade with someone and not to give someone chance after chance after chance. But that's a different thing, because if it's a farmer versus, you know, someone who's trying to take advantage of me, I think that that's the one thing I've seen a little bit better now is who's trying to take advantage of me versus who is really genuine in their mistakes. Maybe
here's Lee Mayer of Havenly. you said that you aggressively sought feedback on the first version of your software. So what does aggressively mean? And how do customers feel about that?
Yeah, it's, I mean, aggressively, I think, means like, listen, I come across so many earlier stage entrepreneurs that when you give them feedback, they kind of don't listen. There's like and there's a natural defensiveness. This is your idea. This is your baby. Like, you don't want it. Yeah, you know, you don't want to hear that it might not work in the way that you think it's going to work. And even now, I still have that gut reaction, right? Like, oh, well, but that's not it. You know, customers are customers. I'm privileged to have them and I have to listen to what they want. And so when I say aggressively seek feedback, it typically means like, go out, get a lot of it, and just don't go out to your mom, because your mom's going to be biased, right? Your best friend's biased. Mm-hmm. Go out to people that don't know you and ask them for advice, feedback, and most importantly, this is like critical, a lot of people miss this, see if they'll be willing to open their wallet for you. Mm-hmm. So it's when the rubber meets the road. Like, that's like, will they be willing to pay for this product?
Well, but if your first product isn't anywhere close to what your reiterated product is going to be, how do you correlate whether they'll pay?
It's tough. And I think, you know, part of it is whether you will pay and what you will pay are two very different things. So typically, the harder part when you're first starting a company, in my opinion, is just whether they will pay. Yeah. Will they even bother to reach into their wallet and pull out $5 for you?
Yep.
And that, I think, is like the first question. The second question is how much they will pay, of course.
Yeah, I developed a failed app, which I'm not proud of. But I talked with some of my customers, and this guy goes, oh my God, this is such an awesome app. I'd pay real money for that. I'm like, well, how much is real money?
Yeah.
He goes, like, $1.99.
Yeah. You know, like, people, I mean, I so many of us, when I like see an app that costs money, I think, you know, and it's 99 cents. I can afford 99 cents. I'm an entrepreneur, but I still can afford 99 cents.
Yeah.
But I think twice about it. And I think that that's, you know, that's something that you really need to figure out. And so I always recommend, like, do something lean, figure out if there's value, listen to feedback, and like really listen.
Yeah.
You know?
So now after you really listened, you created a version 2, which you probably thought was everything you ever wanted. Right? How close was it?
It wasn't that close. Even now, I mean, to be perfectly honest, even now, I feel like we're so far away from where the ultimate vision is. And that's like a constant frustration. And, you know, for me as an entrepreneur, but also like a level of excitement that there's still, you know, so far to go.
Kevin Ness of Inscripta, a company that just raised $85 million to market gene editing technology. So you're doing kind of what Linux computer software did, right? You're saying, look, it's out there now. Now it's crowdsourced as far as improvements and research and all that, right? You're giving it a way to unlock these avenues to development.
You got it. So that ultimately our goal here with this is to create more genome editors. That's like step one. And why we put this out there, again, we feel this is such a profound technology that can help feed, fuel, and heal humanity. And by having great ideas not in the game, not being done, is a disservice to us as kind of a species.
Yeah. Now, go ahead.
So we gave that away. We did this back in December. And like I said, we wanted to create more genome editors because that feeds into the performance.
I have to add,
I
want to let you continue, but I have to interject my amazement when I was on your website and you click the button that says download the gene sequence. And I downloaded it and there were like 3,000 some hundred characters of, you know, various, and I didn't know what to do with it, but I was actually, it's kind of an amazing thought to think now on my computer, I have the genome sequence.
I love the fact that you went and did that.
It's crazy.
And since December, many, many, many people have done that, and we've helped enable a lot of scientists that do know what to do with that sequence.
Yes, thank you. Thankfully, there are some.
To start to get in. And previous academic researchers have had access to these molecular enzymes, but what's so unique about what we did is we're giving this to all commercial R&D also.
Wow.
Which really is going to enable a lot of product lines and opportunities to go forward.
Chris Wright, Liberty Oilfield Services. This CEO really speaks his mind about the fracking industry.
I'm pro energy and human opportunity, but I would flip it the other way. The biggest problem we have right now is we have over 1 billion people in the world with no access to electricity. We still have 10% of the world population, 750 million people that live on less than $2 a day. Without oil and gas, women spend hours every day walking to gather wood and sticks. They got to go far away to find fresh water. Mm-hmm. You bring oil and gas or electricity to a village. Yep. Now you've got energy packaged. You got a pump that delivers water. You free women and you move towards a modern life. You grow life expectancy. You grow human opportunities. So to make the world better, we actually need more oil and gas, not less.
So I'm going to, listeners may think that you're a typical pro oil and gas guy, and yet you've got really contrarian views around some of these things. In fact, I heard you speak at the Opportunity Coalition. You said some things that surprised me. So let me bounce, there are three of them. Let me bounce all three of them off of you.
You bet.
One quote is, our industry has been terrible, terrible, terrible regarding PR.
We are, and I think we're starting to get better, but we're still bad, but maybe we've advanced from terrible, terrible, terrible to maybe just a single terrible.
Yeah.
But when I was a kid in high school, so this is 30 plus years ago, everybody knew oil and gas was bad and greedy and dirty. And I knew that for sure because everyone around me told me it was so. So if that's the image of your industry, what do? They kept their heads down. They dealt with the government officials they needed to. And they didn't engage with the public. And when they did, it was sort of these scripted bullet points that nobody believed anyway. So they just kept their head down. And when they talked, they were so paranoid, they didn't speak candidly. And that's not a way to ingratiate yourself to the public. So we've got ourselves in the position we are today, of our own doing.
Here's Lorena Contarovici of Maria Empanada.
So then is when you hear people that tells you, I will do this, I will put beans, I will do that, blah, blah, blah. Well, if I will react to those, it will be desperation. So it will not be my product. It will be the result of a desperation action for people to come back. But what I decided is to stick with my cultural product, with what I really want. And I'm not putting cilantro, I'm not putting beans, and I'm not putting rice. I mean, this is an Argentinian style empanada. So the message here is once you know what you want, stay with that. Even that probably will be a sacrifice. It will take time for people to know and you need to be staying with what you're saying.
Well, that's interesting because one of the things I noticed about your growth is that while it's been fast, it hasn't been explosive. And it seems like you've got a pace that you're comfortable with. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, I'm a person that I love to test everything. So I'm love to go slow and to try that everything goes well. The business is not only your product, right? The business is your management. The business is your people. The business is your kitchen. The business is your provider. The business is your clientele. So there are a lot of things, ingredients in that recipe of your business. So I am a person that I love to make sure that every single ingredient is in the right place with the right quantity.
Robert Thompson of Punch Bowl Social. This story is a great one because Robert had his ups and downs and it's coming out quite well. You'll enjoy this clip.
All that happened, right? So I lost all my businesses. I lost my house.
Wow.
Yeah, I lost everything. I went from, a pretty successful career at a young age to literally not having enough money to necessarily feed myself adequately. It was that extreme.
Yeah.
And, I think I've kind of lived a life of those sorts of extremes.
Hmm. When you think back on it, can you still feel it or are you past it?
Past it. Mm-hmm. Because I beat it. Hmm. And, when I beat something, I look back on it as a sense of pride, not a, it's one of the things I'm most proud of in my whole life is going through that, counterpunching and being where I'm at today.
Tamara Ryan, the Women's Bean Project, a tremendous nonprofit here in Colorado.
Lots of things like that happen along the way. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Again, because we're always in training mode. So right. we have we hire about every 8 weeks. So we have a new group starting.
You're never, I mean, most businesses just can't wait for the day when people are trained and they can just produce right. and become more and more efficient. You never dream to be more efficient, do you?
Yes and no. I think we need a certain amount of efficiency, but the onus is on us to be great at training. Mm-hmm. So we need to get the women up to speed as quickly as possible and have great training. So that we can be as efficient as possible. The great thing in a way about always hiring new women is that those who have tenure with us can step up to leadership roles.
Yeah.
And so I think what happens a lot of times is women discover leadership that they didn't even know they had.
That's so interesting to me in today's world where workers are in such high demand and such a short supply. Most employers don't want to hire people that require a lot of training. And you've figured out, well, that's just what you do. That's what you have to do, right?
It's what we do. And also what we find is that the skills we're teaching are what every employer needs and what these entry-level workers are lacking. So we're focused on, yes, we produce our products, but we're focused on attendance and punctuality and paying attention to detail and communication skills and conflict resolution.
Well, it's funny, too. In your book, you say, most businesses try to hire the best workers. Women's Bean Project hires the worst. I mean, that sounds like it's kind of the crux of it.
It absolutely is. It's helping someone who I think really has never believed that she's worthy of something better. She doesn't believe she's worthy of being hired by somebody who's going to care that she comes to work every day or is going to be invested in her to have a future.
Lena Phoenix and Steven Sashin of Zero Shoes.
Yeah, the biggest problem we have is the day we launch a product is the day we get 100 emails from people saying, oh, that's great, but what I also want is this.
Yeah.
And so then we
tough
have
problem
to
have.
It actually is. We have to be very diligent about how we expand the line. Mm-hmm. So we don't want to add a new product that's catering to a smaller segment of the audience necessarily.
Right.
We have finite resources, so we can't do everything.
It's easy to chase a loud, passionate voice into a bad place.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that is well said.
Thank you. So I noticed that you were trying to get some, when you went on Shark Tank, were you trying to get funding?
Yeah.
Or was that really a visibility thing?
Both.
Yeah.
Because you turned down, it was a ridiculous offer. You wanted half of your company for some nominal amount of money.
$400,000.
Wait, I want to pause there. Yeah. I love that you said nominal amount of money. It was $400,000.
Well, a lot of money, but.
For some people, I mean, what was amazing after the show is the number of people who emailed us for whom $400,000 was a lot of money.
Well, of course it's a lot of money, but your business was already stood up. It was already running.
Right? I agree.
Yeah.
But it was very entertaining hearing people call us idiots because we turned down such an amazing amount of money. Mm-hmm. But we went on with the hope that we were going to make a deal. In fact, the real problem is that our biggest hope was we were going to make a deal with Barbara because she was the only one of the sharks at the time who was actually retired and working with the companies she invested in.
You wanted her actual
help. Yeah, she's a brilliant marketer.
She's a brilliant marketer. Prior to going on the show, Stephen and I spent months preparing. So each of the sharks had a book and we read their book or books.
What they like, what they want to know.
Exactly. Yeah. And we were just super impressed with Barbara's marketing savvy. And but for some reason, she hated Stephen on site. She just apparently reminded her of somebody she didn't like.
Did she say something?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Her opening line was, I hated you from the moment you walked out here. You remind me of my ex-husband.
Dave Benninghausen of Noodles & Company. What a great story of resurgence. When I think of a part-time person working, whether it be at Noodles or one of your competitors or faster food or slower, I have this impression that they're not all that committed, deeply loyal, deeply rooted in their employer.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you really want to go there.
It gives me a ton of confidence, actually, when you look at the millennial generation and the generation that follows, Generation Z, I think it is. One thing you're seeing with that generation is they do care more about how that company's corporate responsibility, how they engage with the community. It makes a big difference. And one thing we talk about with our general managers, we just had them in Las Vegas for our biannual conference of all our managers. I tried to share with them that these kids that are 17 years old and 18 years old, outside of their parents, there's probably not a single person in their life that is having more of an influence today on what they'll become and how they grow up and how they view the work environment than they are. And if they take that type of attitude, our general managers, they can do amazing things and really steer just wonderful things out of these young kids. If they just view them as somebody that's going to be there to saute or be there to run over cash register, we're in trouble.
I'm your host, Dave Tabor, and today on ProCo 360, I've shared a compilation, sort of a best of excerpts from 2018. Again, thanks for joining me on ProCo 360, where we say live, work, love Colorado, because you and I and my guests define success in more than one dimension. We can be successful anywhere, and we choose Colorado. Please help this show thrive by subscribing to the podcast on your app and submitting a review. Also by subscribing to the newsletter at ProCo360.com. Thanks again to show sponsors, MicroStar Keg Logistics, Community Banks of Colorado, Jones and Keller, and the Colorado Chamber of Commerce. And thanks to show engineer Mike here at 3rd and James Studio. That's the show. That's the year. Live, work, love Colorado.